Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today's show, we bring you two what I would call not only successful and strong, but productive, highly productive women.
Two great ladies, isn't it?
Oh, two great ladies.
No question about that.
Yeah, no, they're two different perspectives.
Before we slide into that, let's do a little bit of home fire thumping here and say congratulations to Single Thread in Healdsburg, California.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Because they were just announced 2 days ago as winners of the One to Watch.
Yes.
In the World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards. And it's an interesting couple. One's a farmer. The other's a restaurateur. Guess which is the farmer?
She is.
You guessed and you got it wrong.
No.
Well, Anna already knew. She cheated. I'll bet you out there didn't necessarily know that.
Yeah, I hope that we got to see them at in Spain because we've never interviewed them and I've never met them.
I'm sure we will. We met last year's One to Watch,
right,
in Melbourne, and in about 2 weeks we're going to be having lunch at Disfrutar in Barcelona.
Oh, good.
So I'm sure we can go out of our way and find these two K's. There's Katie and I can't remember the other guy's, name. It's a K. And their restaurant is called... What's it called? I've forgotten. Single Thread.
I didn't know what you were talking about.
It seems to me like it's Double Thread, but it's called Single Thread.
Single Thread.
And the restaurant's in the beautiful, charming little town of Healdsburg.
But it includes the farm.
California's wine country.
Yeah.
And I don't know, relatively speaking, where the farm is, I'm not sure. But you'll be hearing more about those people, I feel absolutely sure.
I'm really going to be looking forward to interviewing them.
Yeah, we hope to bring them to you in person before the end of June. So... just a little bit of news to tickle your fancy. And now
there's so much to do. So much is going on.
Now, who are we introducing? We didn't forget.
Oh, today's show.
Today's show.
First
up, one of the great ladies of... Which one are we going to do first?
Anissa Haler.
We're going to do Anissa Haler, okay.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's like a volume to... I mean, it's huge. And it is so thoroughly researched. It was a 5-year effort. And she's a great lady anyhow, Anissa. And it's the food. Every single recipe has like a lesson with it. Not a lesson, that sounds too preachy. But it has a story. And you learn something just reading the headers on every single recipe.
And she splits her time between London
and
Trapani.
Trapani, which
funnily
is
enough,
great.
Her favorite restaurant in London is a Lebanese restaurant called Awaha, which we have been to and we interviewed the chef at. And her favorite part of Sicily is Trapani, where Anne wants to go live.
Yes.
And I just put her in touch with a retired pediatrician that we knew.
She's wonderful.
Who has an olive farm and a vineyard not far from Trapani.
So you know, when you're dealing with food, you're dealing with a shrinking world. Everybody seems connected.
Oh, no question about it.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So here's Anissa.
Before we forget to play the interview, Anissa Haler.
I'm trying to balance this latest book from Anissa Haler on my knee, and it is... Well, I described it to her as, in my view, it's an encyclopedic resource in the food of the Islamic world. And it is so thoroughly researched that Anissa says, Anissa, by the way, is not a newbie to this business. She's a chef, a food writer, a journalist, artist, experienced with the art world, and on and on and on, and the author of many books. But this one you outdid yourself, Anissa. It's called Feast, Food of the Islamic World. And it is a masterpiece. You said it took 5 years to write. And I would say you only managed to get it written in 5 years because you were born and raised in the Middle East and lived there a long time. So you already knew a lot of things. First question is, when I looked at this map, what were your guidelines in establishing what constituted the Islamic world?
Basically, it's countries majority Muslim, with a majority Muslim population. And also, I followed the sort of Islamic empires from way back, and it hasn't really changed that arc that I followed, you know, from Morocco at the west, on the west, and, you know, Senegal and African countries, to all the way east to Muslim China, even. But a long time ago, were ruled by Muslim dynasties. And so, I mean, Indonesia is out of it, and Indonesia, funnily enough, today is the most populous Muslim, the country with the most populous Muslim.
And I read that, and I didn't believe it. It's true?
It is true. It's over 200 million Muslims live in Indonesia. And, of course, you have Malaysia as well.
Yes.
So, but it is the country, the most populous Muslim country. Although they have Christian, you know, Christians, Chinese Christians, and other religions, but majority Muslims, and one province in Indonesia, Banda Aceh or Aceh, is the only one where they actually ruled by Sharia law.
Really?
You know, where they had the tsunami.
Well, you know, we interviewed somebody who wrote a book about the cuisine of this little bit of China that's Muslim. I can't remember what it's called. What's it called?
I guess it's Uyghur. I mean, I don't know, maybe... I don't know the book, but I did go to Uyghur country, and I went to Xi'an as well, and it was very interesting. It was very different from the rest of China.
Right, yeah. I mean, it was a totally different cuisine, really.
And it's the only place where they have bread. I mean, normally in China you don't have bread. You do have, like, pancakes and stuff. But there they have proper bread.
Well, you know, I mean, you would agree with Massimo Bottura, whose latest book is called Bread is Gold, right? Because you have a huge first introductory chapter called Bread. And bread is essential to the Muslim cuisine, right?
It is. Well, there are two staples. One is bread and the other is rice. And some countries have bread as a staple, others have rice as a staple, and some have both as a staple, but they eat them at different times.
Now, I don't know if I'd try some of these recipes look like I could actually make these breads, even though I don't have a tandoori. The one that really looked good was this Arabian date bread. I've never had that.
It's very good.
You were helped in this book by the fact that you have many contacts in the Islamic world. You had a lot of contacts in Syria. And so you got to actually sample food that most Westerners just will never get a hold of.
That's true.
Yeah, like, I mean, I expect I will never, ever have a camel hump.
Well, maybe if you're lucky enough to be invited at a feast in Saudi Arabia or in the Emirates, you might just get a camel hump. But I chased my camel hump for quite a bit before I got mine.
Yes, I heard that it was through a personal contact that you finally managed to land some, right?
That's true. That's true. I was very lucky to have a lovely friend who gave me a whole baby camel.
And Lisa, it's interesting. One of our nephews is married to a lady who's a doctor, but she's from Mongolia.
She lives in the UK.
She lives in just outside London. But she made a dish for us once on one of our visits, and she just called it dried meat.
And what was it like? Was it good?
It was...
Camel.
You needed all your teeth.
Oh, my God. I didn't know. You know, it's one of those things where you get it in your mouth and you start chewing, and you can't figure how when you're at the table. How are you going to get it out of your mouth without making yourself embarrassed and embarrassing your hostess?
That's when the camel is too old and it's very chewy and quite indigestible.
But your baby camel, you say, is good?
Yeah, baby camel is completely different. I mean, it's a milk-fed animal and the meat is not as tender as, let's say, baby milk-fed veal or milk-fed lamb, but it's pretty tender. It's very, it's completely different from a grown camel, which is, I mean, some people like it, but I have had it in Syria, and it's not very good. It's usually minted because it's tough.
You know, the other thing that I'm not so crazy about is the Mongolian lamb stew, which involves, as far as I can tell, you cut off the head of the lamb and throw it in a pot and fill it with water and boil it forever.
You fill the head with water or the pot?
No, the pot with water. So my nephew probably gets sick every time he goes there and eats it.
Well, I can't say it's one of the greatest cuisines, but I mean, you know.
But I never realized until Teshka that how primitive it was, the cuisines, really. Because, you know, somebody.
It is, right?
Yeah, but they've traveled. The Mongols traveled everywhere. I mean, you'd think they'd have absorbed some.
They kind of stopped traveling around the time of Genghis Khan, which is 800 years ago.
Yeah. Anyhow, did you learn anything? I mean, you know so much. You did so much research. What surprised you the most in your research about foods in the Islamic world?
Well, it was interesting to see how far the influences went. I mean, like when I started looking at Indian Mughal dishes, and even though they didn't resemble Persian dishes, but you could see that they were influenced initially by Persian food, you know, with the biryanis, and how many different variations of biryanis there are, because, you know, one thinks biryani and you think, okay, you know, biryani, rice and meat. But in fact, there are endless variations. And also in the bread, there were discoveries. When I was in Zanzibar, I was in Zanzibar during Ramadan, and I went to futari, which is breaking the fast, at a family. And she was making a bread with very, very, very loose dough. And then she baked it in a frying pan, basically, and let the bread stick and then turned over the pan, over the fire to bake, I mean, the top of the bread. So things like this, I mean, it wasn't like major discoveries, but there were techniques or variations on dishes that I was familiar with that I didn't know, like a sweet rice in Pakistan. I didn't really know that you could have a rice dish more or less as a dessert. It's a festive dish. It's not really a dessert, but it's a sweet, more sweet than savory rice dish with meatballs. Very interesting, very intriguing.
Well, you're living in Sicily, so you know this sweet and sour taste very well, huh?
Yes.
I do too. I've been grateful for that.
No, they haven't. It's much more subtle, let's say, in Sicily. But all this comes from ancient Persia, basically, because what happened is then when the Abbasid dynasty settled in with Baghdad as their capital and they invaded Persia, they took the Persian cooks and then took them with them wherever they invaded. And as a result, Persian cuisine had noticeable influence on, I mean, I don't really like to talk about Islamic cuisine, but on the food of the Islamic world as such. And the Ottomans took that and made it their own, and then the Mughals made it, you know, took both influences and made it their own. So, and at the end of the day, you have three great cuisines in that world. One is the Persian, which is the mother cuisine, then the Ottoman, which was an incredible, refined cuisine with thousands of cooks in the Topkapi Palace. And then the Mughals with their fabulous sort of palaces and cooks everywhere in Lucknow, you know, and it wasn't very long. I mean, the empire didn't last very long, but they had a very, very, I mean, great civilization and culture.
Now, one of the things that's interesting is the section you have, is it a chapter or a section, on all the spice blends.
And there's
a commonality of the spice blends across the different cuisines as well, right?
It's true, yeah. And some countries use the spices in a very complex but subtle way. Like if Moroccans blend their spices in a very balanced way, very subtle, whereas the Indians, you know, when I say more heavy-handed, I don't mean that they use them without restraint, but they use more spices. And in the Arabian Gulf, they use an enormous variety. Like in one dish, you could have, I don't know, up to, apart from that spice blend, the Arabian spice blend that's called Gzar, they add more spices, individual spices. And in one dish, you could have like a dozen spices or more. But, you know, it's never overwhelming. It's just kind of a wonderful, complex combination of spices that heightens the flavor of the dish.
We interviewed someone who wrote a book about that the cuisine of that region. I don't remember who it was. And as it turned out, I was making chicken soup that day, and we looked, and there was a recipe for Yemeni chicken soup. And ever since I found that recipe, I've been adding turmeric to my chicken soup.
Yes,
and
which
it's
is
really
a lovely
good.
Idea. Yeah. And healthy.
And healthy, of course. Chicken soup is.
Now, I wanted to mention that in addition to these wonderful recipes, before each recipe, you have explanations, comments on what you're talking about, I mean, the recipe part, absolutely filled with fascinating information about the history of, what was it? Oh, eggplant. I was shocked about the origins of eggplant. Tell us about that.
Oh, gosh, I have a terrible memory. So what I write, I research and write, I forget about not too much. But I think the eggplant came to Iran via India, and then was taken to the Arab world. And it's not, I mean, now in the Mediterranean, you think of eggplant as an absolutely native vegetable, but it wasn't.
Right. There are a number of things like that when you trace back the origins of the ingredients, and some of them are rather amazing. Now, here's another recipe I'll never make, is the Saudi camel meatballs.
Well, you should make it because it's very simple. As long as you can get minced camel meat.
Well, there's a lot of recipes here for kebabs.
Yeah, well, the kebabs is another, like, common thread from one end to the next, to the other of that.
Extensive the repertoire is for kibbeh. You know, I mean, I just know it all as late.
Enormous. I mean, I only, like, have a few in the book, but I think you could write a whole book on just kibbeh.
See, I just knew the one variety you either do it cooked or raw, but it was just ground lamb with seasonings.
Yes, and Belgian wheat.
And wheat, right.
Now, Anissa, you live some of the year in Italy, in Trapani, in western Sicily, but you also live in London. One of our most amazing and very pleasant surprises, one of our trips to London, was when we went to a Lebanese restaurant called Al Waha.
Yeah.
And
my favorite in London.
So you know it. But the thing that was interesting is that before we started on the main meal, our table was filled with appetizers.
Yeah.
There were like
14. The Lebanese meze.
The meze,
okay.
Yeah.
So that's particularly Lebanese more than it's across the...
I would say Levantine, because you have it in Turkey, you have it in Jordan, in Syria, in Palestine, all these little nibbles, let's say. You also have it in Greece. They vary from one country to country, the flavors, the selection, the way the same dish can be prepared, like, let's say, vine leaves, stuffed vine leaves. In Turkey, they could cook, parboil the rice before they stuff it. In Lebanon, they use the rice completely raw. And in Iran, they can have it with pomegranate syrup for a sweet and savory flavor. One dish can be made in 100 different ways.
And another place where they did a lot of appetizers was Puglia.
Oh, Puglia, yeah. We had lots of that.
Yeah, well, the antipasti in Italy are, I don't know if they go back to the Mezzet tradition, but it's a little bit like that. You have a table laden with different antipasti, and then you help yourself, and then they charge you accordingly. It's very amusing.
Yeah, we never understood how they figured out what you ate, to tell you the truth. Now, the other thing is, I knew biryani as just like one dish, and you have, every country has the same version.
Yes, yes. It's a very, very interesting dish.
And what's the origin?
You can have it.
What's the origin?
I would say the origin would probably be, again, the Persian pilaf, because in Iran you have, it's not biryani, it's pilaf, but they layer the rice, sometimes with meat or sometimes with vegetables or other times with herbs. In the Indian biryani or the Arabian biryani, is more substantial and headier because it's got spices and most of the time it has meat. Sometimes it has the meat is marinated in yogurt and spices, and it's just it's a very, very interesting dish. And sometimes the meat is put at the bottom of the pan uncooked. And the first time I saw it prepared like this in Hyderabad, I thought the meat will never cook. But in fact, it did cook and became very tender. But they marinate the meat with green papaya, which is a tenderizer.
Okay, so it was tender but not cooked. It was sort of like ceviche or something.
No, it's completely cooked.
Oh, it is cooked.
It was put in the pot roll.
It's still raw, but it cooks with the rice, and by the end, you know, the rice doesn't take that long to cook, and the meat takes longer, but by the end, this particular biryani, the meat cooks just, I mean, tender, and the rice is perfect.
Well, you know, I think people who think they know, say, this Middle Eastern cuisine, and we'll call it Islamic world cuisine, are going to be greatly surprised by a number of your recipes. And I'm looking at the one for Zanzibari sweet noodles. Never did I hear of that.
Yeah, that was in Zanzibar. Very delicious, actually. And they're eaten to break the fast during Ramadan.
Uh-huh. Of course,
they have them in the Emirates as well, but usually in the Emirates they're eaten for breakfast.
Right. Well, I had an assignment when I was writing for the magazine on the foods of Ramadan, and mm-hmm. the only common denominator I found worldwide for breaking the fast were dates. That was all. Everything else
was
just...
Yes, actually, in Indonesia, they could, but they don't. They break their fast with sweet drinks and sweetish snacks, and then they move on to proper food.
Uh-huh.
But the date was what the Prophet Muhammad, he broke his fast with 3 dates, right. And that's why it is such a kind of sacred and important fruit in both of for Muslims across the world.
Right. Now, you have Bangladeshi fish head risotto, which is an unusual one. I didn't even ever know that the Egyptians fermented fish. In fact, the Iranian fish sauce was a surprise. And you mentioned tahini. I was really amazed. Weren't you surprised by some of these?
Yeah. I mean, I knew fish head curry from Singapore. I had had it before. But fish is an interesting, fish is an interesting food from the point of view that you don't have as many recipes for fish as you have, let's say, for meat or for rice, mainly because fish is so precious that people either cook it plain, grill it or fried or whatever, and then in some cases they have elaborate dishes, festive dishes on the whole. I mean, talking about fish, I just bought a huge fish today for dinner for friends of mine. I think it weighs like 4 or 5 kilos. And I was very tempted to make it the sort of festive Iranian way, stuffed with dried fruit and nuts and basted with a saffron sauce, but at the end we're going to make it very simple.
Well, I must say again, this book is, it's just a whole new world of delight called Feast, Food of the Islamic World by Anissa Helou. And you get your fill of there are also vegetables, there are sweets to consider, and thankfully a glossary as well, Adisa.
True.
Well, I knew
even though now with Google, people can just research anything online.
And the other thing, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the photography, which is just gorgeous.
Well, yes, I had a friend of mine, Christian Perez, do the photos, and Claire Pitak, who has Violet Cakes in London, and I did the food for the photography. So we were like a brilliant team, and Christian took wonderful photos. And then the little photos in the chapter openers were taken by me on my travels.
Oh, great, but they're lovely. And I know in photography, you and Alan Jenkins always exchange flower photos. I once asked him what that was about, but I can't remember the answer. Right? Photos of flowers. Anyhow, I wish you much, much luck on this.
Thank you very much.
Actually, not so much luck as success, because you don't need a lot of luck. Just people will just take it on, this book, and just be mesmerized by the food of the Islamic world.
Thank you so much.
So if you explore our website under Trapani, you'll find an interview that we did with a retired pediatrician who had a olive orchard and a small winery not too far from Trapani.
I don't remember that at
all. Check it out.
We went there for an olive oil tasting.
Oh, I remember it. That's a woman chef.
Yes, it was
wonderful. Do you know her?
I don't know. What's her name?
I can't remember, but it'll be on our... go on Audio Archives on our website and just find on this page Trapani, and you'll find it.
No, okay, I'll check it out.
We don't have her email with her.
Oh, do I have... I don't. I negotiate with you on Twitter. Can we have your email address so we can email you when this is going to air? So anyhow,
okay, great.
Yeah, and so you'll hear from us then. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Peter.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we will be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
husband and the book called My American Dream is a good example of what contributions immigrants can make to this country and what this country should be offering potential immigrants. Enough with all the static over immigration by Trump and Trumpers. Lydia Bastianich she had such a hard life. And this book is not her usual cookbook, because with all her recipes, I know you all adore her recipes and her cooking shows. But this gives you a picture that you may not have had about the whole immigration issue.
And how immigrants can demonstrate just exactly how successful they can be given even a slim chance.
Yes. So let's listen to Lydia Bastianich and get a hold of her book called My American Dream. Is a good example of what contributions immigrants can make to this country and what this country should be offering potential immigrants. Enough with all the static over immigration by Trump and Trumpers. Lydia Bastianich she had such a hard life. And this book is not her usual cookbook, because with all her recipes, I know you all adore her recipes and her cooking shows. But this gives you a picture that you may not have had about the whole immigration issue.
And how immigrants can demonstrate just exactly how successful they can be given even a slim chance.
Yes. So let's listen to Lydia Bastianich and get a hold of her book called My American Dream. Lydia Matakio Bastianich is a superstar in just about every regard. Her television, her books. She has finally written her memoir, or a memoir. It may not be the last memoir she writes, called My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. And you really are blessed in terms of your family, aren't you, Lydia?
Very much. It's been a trip. Us Italians, we're very close with our family. We love our family. But in my case, especially, the trek that we did ultimately immigrating to America was always about being with the family, close-knit, and that was our support. That was where I felt secure. And so this day, that's so important to me.
Now, you lived a piece, growing up, you lived a piece of history that most people in the United States, most people around the world don't even remember happened.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, yes, I was born right after, in 1947, sort of right after the war, and I was born in Istria. Istria is a little peninsula that is northeast of Venice, and it was Italy. After World War II, Italy lost the war. That whole area and a piece of Dalmatia was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia, and we were caught behind the Iron Curtain. The border went down, and we were under communism, just like that. And under communism, everything changed. Our name, our language.
Here's a funny thing, Lydia. I won't say you're old enough to remember, but I'm old enough to remember, and Anne is old enough to remember. You remember when you went to the movies, there was like a newsreel that preceded the main feature?
Yes.
And the first of those that I can remember was all about a place called Trieste. And the conflict that was going on between Italy and Yugoslavia. And this would have been right around about 1950.
Yes, because in 1947, the Paris Treaty delineated the border. And Trieste remained under Italy, whereas Istria and the rest were given to the communist Yugoslavia. Now, Tito, who was the sort of the
president of Yugoslavia, wanted Trieste, and he was relentless. So even in the 50s, he was still kind of nudging at trying to get Trieste. And yeah, it was a problematic region.
Well, I used to get confused about what was where, and Peter explained to me it's because everything sort of got moved around. So it was not the same. It was changed. Language, culture, the whole thing, right?
Yeah, well, you know, on one side of the border was communism, and on the other side was Italy, which, you know, yes, it was fascist, but it became democratic after the war and continued to be democratic. So, you know, it was a very unsettling time because for Italy, too, because of the fascist regime and having to deal with all the leftovers of that regime and, you know, switching back to a democracy of Italy.
Right. Now, everything, though, if people wonder how you have ended up where you are with your cooking, your food, your family, the whole focus of this book, you have markers at just about every stage in your life, and you point them out in your book as to how this influenced you, starting with your grandmother in the courtyard.
Well, you know, it's not kind of markers that, you know, I knew I was going to go there. It's where life took me. And yes, my formative years under communism were still, for me, were special. And in the sense that my mother put me with my grandmother in the country, out of the city. You know, the cities were the problem zones, if you will, as far as politics.
Right.
And out in the country, grandma had her ducks, her chickens. We had rabbits. We had goats. She had pigs. She made her own olive oil with my grandfather, wine. And so there was a peaceful life, almost an idyllic life, where food was grown, made. We used to harvest, you know, ripe figs, dry them in the sun for the winter. The beans, you know, the beans, string beans, in when they first came out in June, May, June, then to let them mature, and they would become the dry beans. We would chuck them and dry them in the sun, and they would become the beans for the minestra and the pasta fagioli for the rest of the year. So we would milk the goats. I would help grandma milk the goats. We would make goat cheese, ricotta. And so I grew up in those, with those flavors and with those aromas and smell. I mean, we had big hedges of rosemary. I remember we used to play hide and seek. And we used to hide in the rosemary bushes. Can you imagine? I would come out smelling like rosemary for the rest of the day. And, you know, you just can't forget those intensity. But then, 10 years into that, in 1956, actually my parents decided to escape back to Italy because you couldn't leave. The Iron Curtain was up, so my mother, my brother, and I went to Italy. My father followed. They wouldn't allow the whole family to go, and he literally escaped the border. And we were now immigrants back, political immigrants back in Italy. The difficulties of Italy, we ended up in a political refugee camp. And there we stood for 2 years, you know, in a political refugee camp, in a sense closed in. We could only leave when they allowed us to go out, and waiting for a place to be taken in, a country that would take us as a family. And so on in 1958, that did happen, you know. America opened its door. Dwight Eisenhower was the president. And we were accepted, given the opportunity with the visa for America. And, you know, every step of the way, food played a part for me, Anne.
Yes. And, you know, I loved your comments on Catholic Charities because I've known so many families that they have helped, refugees, people from not Vietnam, what's the
Cambodia,
the Cambodians that are in Pittsburgh. They just took them under their wing and got them businesses, well, education.
Well, it's all about these organizations, you know, and helping people. And for us, it was the Catholic Charities and it was the Red Cross. We had nobody here in America. So Who brought us here? It was the Catholic Charities. They took care of us, paid for our trips, helped us settle, find an apartment, found a job for my father, and so on. So for us, you know, they were really the first stepping stone to security, to a new life.
What gave you the... Let's use the question. Let's use the right word. What gave you the balls to say we can open and run a restaurant?
Well, you know, that was, as I said, you know, kind of food accompanied me, was part of my whole life. I didn't know that this is what I wanted to do, or be a chef. But in the camp in Italy, I cooked in the kitchen with the nuns. Then coming to America, I began working in a bakery because to make some money, cook for the family. And ultimately, I met Felice, my husband, who was in the restaurant business. And he was the one that actually said, well, you know, wanted to open a restaurant. And I said, you know what, I will support you. I will go with you. I knew I loved food, but I didn't know that I loved it professionally. And in 1971, we opened our first little restaurant in Forest Hills in the suburbs. And we hired an Italian-American chef. And I became his sous chef. I realized, you know, I said, I got to learn how to manage a kitchen, a big kitchen, a commercial kitchen. And so for 9 years, I was his sous chef. But, you know, I realized that I needed to learn much more, went back to school. We went to Italy every summer. I would work with chefs in Italy. And so really built my strength as a chef. And then in 1981, we sold the restaurants. By then, we had two in the suburbs, and we opened Felidia in New York. And
yeah,
that's where
that
I
one was tough, huh?
That one we almost didn't open because, you know, like, we went way over budget, not knowing that, you know, because there was some unexpected underpinning and cost for the house. And we almost didn't open, but we finally did open it. By the skin of our teeth, as we say, and ultimately, you know, I became the chef there, and that's where it kind of all took off because, you know, everybody was wondering who is this woman, Italian woman.
Yeah, but see, this is something you do point out, but I think it's people ought to pay real attention to this. This was in a different era, and having a woman-owned restaurant and a strong woman chef. And then, of course, with the television, too, on top of that, it was unheard of.
Exactly. But, you know, what I decided to cook was the Italian regional food there. Rather than Italian-American, you know, I knew that in Italy, the regions, the food of the regions is the way it was. And so that also brought the attention of the newspaper and so on.
Uh-huh. Yes, because it was...
Now, was it you or was it Joe who told us that in the early days of Felidia, he used to steal the kids' milk money to buy groceries for the restaurant?
I don't remember.
I think that was Joe.
Somebody told us that. It might have been Joe.
I think it was Joe.
you better wrap him over the knuckles.
I think it was Joe, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it. So, but you have maintained this closeness in the family through all kinds of difficulties. What luck to have Joe come back in the business, to have Tanya decide to work with you, getting her art history back. And I know that's a big accomplishment for her. And everybody working together. And your mother, who's how old now?
97.
And she's still vibrant and living with you?
She still is. She lives with us. You know, she's sharp as a tack. Her legs are giving up a little bit, but, you know, we're so blessed to have her. She was the supporting element throughout all of this, from the, you know, the trip that we took as immigrants coming to America and settling and building our family and building our business. She was the strength that kind of kept us going.
And then the grandchildren, I mean, they were the reasons you started writing the children's books. And I suspect that their concern for your story going on, underlying it all, is also a concern with continuity in your family.
Well, exactly. You know, the kids, when they were small and they wanted to hear stories from me, it was always, Nona, tell us a story when you were a little girl. And then they grew up, you know, they're in their 20s now. And so I thought, as they were going into their teens, I better put these stories down that I'm telling them, so one day they will have them. And so I did write those three children's book with the stories that I used to tell them. And in the meantime, I used to also put down notes, you know, with my life and all that. I knew that someplace down the line I would write a memoir for all of them to keep. But the time came maybe a bit sooner than I had planned, and I'm delighted it did.
Well, now, also very large in your life was getting to cook for not one but two popes. So that's a really major accomplishment. I'd have been so scared.
Yeah, that was kind of a really the highlight of my career, if you will, as a chef, to get to cook for two popes, you know, not one, but two.
Totally different in personality and taste.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was a great blessing, and, you know, it's a big part of my memory, my sentiments as a cook, as a person, as a spiritual sentiment, and so on.
Remind us what you cooked for them. I can't remember.
Well, for Pope Benedict, you know, he was a German descent, so I made goulash, I made sauerkraut, I made spetzel, I made strudel. And on the other hand, for Pope Francis, he was actually he's Argentinian, but he couldn't eat a lot of meat. So from Italy, he comes from Piemonte. And I made risottos for him, agnolini, we made some veal, some fish. We kept it on the light side. But he loves his desserts.
Yeah, you said, but he was always that resistant that he watched me eat, right?
Yes, he was watching a little bit.
It's interesting, some of the things that you cooked for Pope Benedict really hark back to the history of the region where you were born and raised.
Because it
was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Trieste was its port.
Exactly. So you had a lot of, it was under, that area was also under the Austro-Hungarians, and, you know, the goulash, the strudel, all of that is part of that culture. But, you know, when you grow up in a border situation like that, you reflect all of those borders. You speak more than one language and so on. So, when I was asked to cook for him, I said, aha, I'm going to pull out my Austro-Hungarian card here. I'm going to make him happy.
Now, you haven't told us yet how you, I don't know why I have the term slid in my head, into television, but you did, didn't you?
The what?
Television, how you slid into television. I mean, you weren't trained as a television personality.
No, television came about, actually, with Julia Child. You know, when we opened Solidia, she was one of the first persons that came. She and James Beard that came in together.
Oh, that must have been exciting. I read that.
These two big towering figures.
I've been terrified.
And she wanted to know all about risotto, and she wanted to taste risotto, she wanted to know how to make it, and so ultimately we became friends, she came over to the house, I taught her how to make risotto, she invited me to be on her show, the Master Chef series, and that's when, you know, the producer says, oh, Lydia, you're pretty good, how about a show of your own? So it was really due to Julia that I had the opportunity to. And now it's about 20 years that I'm on public television, and I love it.
And you're very loyal to public television. I know that because of your connections with QED here, which is the first public television station in the country, in Pittsburgh.
So, yes, and, you know, I'm connected to all the, as I travel, I always try to fundraise for the local PBS station because, you know, I think it's such a wonderful communication channel, and I want to be on it, and I need to support it if I do.
Well, I mean, I want to say that part of the success of this book and your television series is your very real warmth that comes through. I mean, you feel like, I've always thought of you as a friend, I mean, because you are warm and welcoming. you can tell that your relationships are important to you.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, because especially in the beginning of my life, it was all about relationship. It was all about people that cared, that took the time to help somebody that they didn't even know. So, you know, I think, and I was kind of lucky, given an awful lot, and it's kind of time just for the tables to turn and for me to be there for somebody that needs something. And just, to, you know, grateful to people for being so kind to me along the way. And, you know, just have to be open to people and accept them and understand them, try to understand them, because many people did that for me.
Is there anything in this book that most people will be surprised to read? I mean, I wasn't sure that there was something revealed that I didn't know about you.
Well, there's, I don't know, there's quite a few things that people, as they read it, they tell me, oh, Lydia, I didn't know this. But, you know, initially, Anne, I didn't think that people were interested in my life as an immigrant. I thought, you know, they're interested in Lydia's recipes and Lydia as a chef. And now I find more and more that people are interested in Lydia's life, Lydia's trip, Lydia's, because, you know, it's not unlike the life of many people today and what's happening today out there.
I was going to ask you that next. I mean, you're a prime example of why refugees should be taken in and embraced.
Well, yes, you know, I think I'm a product of that. I was given a chance, and I think if you give somebody a chance that's really in need, it's their responsibility, of course, to make to embrace that and work at it. But unless you give them the chance, we'll never know.
The interesting thing, Lydia, I think about your whole life, and I didn't read the book like Anne did, so I'm not.
I read every word of it.
You probably covered it in there, but I'm not sure. But the amazing thing is that your life has been a circle, because guess where you own land and grow grapes?
Oh, right.
and where is it that you exercise hospitality for Americans or anybody else for that matter, your luxury B&B that we stayed at? So,
or seen.
Can you imagine when it all began that you would finish up where you are today?
Oh, never in my wildest dreams.
Really at the top of the heap, and well,
yeah,
deserved to be there.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you very much.
Yeah, yep. We have to go. We have to go there again soon. We really must.
Yeah,
well, please do come and visit us. You know, it's we took, as you said, 360-degree. We're back at the source with our own little house and a small B&B and a little restaurant and a winery with the wines. And I know you were there, but you're welcome to come anytime you're in that area.
Yeah, one of the things I did discover that I didn't know was that you actually have kept the courtyard and that area that you spent so much wonderful time with your grandmother, and you look after it and keep it in the family, and that's beautiful.
Yeah, I do, and I go there as well. You know, those memories, being there, it kind of re-energizes me. And actually, a lot of parts of this book I wrote there, being in situ in that place.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's my American dream, and it truly is a story of love, family, and food, and it's wonderful knowing you and being able to talk to you, Lydia.
Thanks, Anne. Thanks, Peter. Thank you very much.
Two ladies and two remarkable lifetime achievements, right, sweetheart?
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely no question about it. It's our real pleasure to bring them to you. We hope you enjoyed them as much as we did, and you'll come again and join us same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.